Join us as we cover many an insane movie and numerous cult TV phenomenons. Are you ready to get jacked up? Are you with us? Then listen on.
Welcome, ladies and gents. I got one for the road podcast. Maddie Harrison, how are you?
I am good. How are you doing?
I'm delightful. Thank you much. So I've been looking for people to collaborate, and you know, I already had plenty of episodes already slated that were works of fiction that were inspirational, but like appropriate for various holidays that included Black History Month, President's Day, and International Women's Day. But I was like, still, we got to take down a bunch of true crime like miniseries and like events, because this is the year to be progressive, baby. This is 2022. And so
exactly.
I just knew I had just one in mind that I'd finally gotten around to getting off my ass and seeing, and I was like, yeah, I think if Maddie is covering true crime and other wrongful doings, I'm sure she see this, and she's like, I will check this out. It's only 4 episodes, and lo and behold. So
yeah, I finished it within a day. So
oh sweet. Yeah, man. I had to space it out. It was so brutal. It didn't help that I was watching with a few people and they were like, I just want to watch the follow-up report. It was just so crushing to them just seeing that interrogation in the opening episode.
Oh, I know, that killed me.
I was like, okay, well, I'm going to stomach this over a weekend, but I'm not going to wait on you. So I'm.
Yep.
When They See Us was written and directed by Ada DuVernay. You may know her for Middle of Nowhere and a few other independent films and shorts. She also came to acclaim by helming the historical drama known as Selma. And when I indicated this to a few other people, I was just like, oh, okay, yes, I have heard of this, or at least heard of the Central Park Five. And it really was interesting how it kind of took everyone a moment to see this, because I don't know if they were just getting it mixed up with a similar titled show or what, See Us or something. And it's like, no, this is about the Central Park Five, and it's got a giant all-star cast. They're all completely unrecognizable. You've never seen them in anything like this. The unknown actors, mostly unknown arguably, who play the five, you know, members were, you know, Nickelodeon kids, for God's sakes. This is their first.
I know. I had never seen them in anything else before, and I was like, wow, they are doing like powerhouse performances right now, and I can't believe I haven't seen them in anything else. So
totally. The Guardian's Lucy Mangan has a quote on this. I think this sums it up pretty good. So for those who haven't heard about it, a dense, fast-moving series that examines not just the effects of systematic racism, but the effects of all sorts of disenfranchisement, though you could argue they all have that same root cause, on people with the boys' background. The lack of money that leads to inadequate lawyers and mothers unable to visit their sons incarcerated in distant places. The lifetime of fear and vulnerability that causes one parent to encourage his son to sign the confession, so they can leave the station and sort things out later. The powerlessness is in the face of an authority that doesn't look like you or care about you. So I think that's the best way to put it. But Yeah, no, I mean, I was really surprised when I was even looking at like a bit of fact checking, just how many people were like slamming this. And, you know, I listened to the Young Turks and their stuff. So I knew about, you know, various corporations that, you know, can do some political slander. But, you know, I'd already seen, fortunately, the attorney who, you know, is documented in here, you know, how she had stepped down, this had been reopened. And
yeah,
it's Linda Fairstein. You know, I had heard that name because she had inspired, you know, the sex crimes unit, as well as Detective Benson on, you know, Mariska Hargitay's character in Law and Order. So it's like, I knew what she represented, but I also knew that it was kind of questionable to how, you know, how she had gotten her whole thing. And she had done some other shady stuff, like been reportedly involved with the defense of Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, and like,
I really am surprised she's been around this long with all these things, dents on her record.
Seriously, I know. And then she wrote like multiple books, and you know, when she stepped down, I'm like, I hope nobody's buying those books. Like,
oh yeah, and you read even just like the names of them, Final Jeopardy, Death Dance, they all sound like very bad, like James Patterson or Lifetime type movies. I'm like, geez.
Yeah, it's like, you know, she wrote them, like, you know, she created that title.
Mm-hmm. Direct-to-video movies. Yeah. So, yeah, no, I know. Like we were saying before we started this out, is like, yeah, it was kind of under talked about. Like, I knew certain beloved actors were in it, like Michael K. Williams from The Wire and Blair mm-hmm. Underwood, of all people, once again playing a lawyer from LA Law. And then, but yeah, that it's just all star cast. Like, there's a police lieutenant played by William Sadler. There's Famke Janssen from X-Men as the lawyer who defends one of the boys, and Anjuan Ellis, who you guys might know from movies and shows like Men of Honor and Designated Survivor, playing Yusef's mother. I was like, yeah, but I mean, I'm not crazy about Vera Farmiga, but yeah, she did good here.
Really?
Yeah, unfortunately, I know.
I love her.
I do love Bates Motel, though, so I will give you that. But yeah, I mean, Felicity Huffman plays Linda Fairstein, and yeah, John Leguizamo has a very small role as Santana Sr. But yeah, I mean, I was just really even surprised just all the various other actors who come into here, and I was just like just playing the various community organizers and other supporting lawyers, like all the boys had to be repped, and they all had to go with some kind of predicament because they're all afraid of being, you know, incarcerated together.
Yeah, exactly.
Logan Marshall like, Green, who plays the one of the prison guards, Roberts, did okay here, and I'm not crazy about him either. But yeah,
I wasn't crazy about him in the show either. But
he just has a bland face to me, and just everything I see him in, where he just looks like he doesn't want to be here, and I don't know if that's just unintentional or what.
Exactly. Well, yeah, if you think about it, though, as a prison guard, I feel like most of them are like, I don't want to be here. So he could have played it pretty well.
Maybe that's what it was. I just haven't liked him in other movies. So.
Yeah.
Oh, but hey, power of a filmmaker. You know, I call this the Law and Order effect. You know, it just, when you serve the purpose and you dial down that you go, you're good at, you can be just good in just the whole thing that you're being used in. So it's
exactly.
Anything else? Well, that's on them. So, yeah, were you already familiar with Ada DuVernay's work?
No, not at all, actually. And I was watching interviews, like she did one with Oprah and a few others, but mainly the Oprah one that I was watching.
I'm really surprised at what a lot of stuff she's done with Oprah. And I think that's just because, I think Oprah was in Selma, so I think, yeah, that started the friendship.
Yeah, exactly. But she's such, like, a powerful woman. I mean, I was watching the interview, and I was like, yes, ma'am, like, this, we need more of you in this world.
Oh, but totally. And she came onto the scene almost around the same time as another independent Black filmmaker, Dee Reyes, who many might know from movies like Pariah and Mudbound. And by the time mm-hmm. she got to make Bessie for HBO, I just knew her star was just going to keep on rising. You know, like she is going to keep you know, doing a lot of LGBT and African-American themed dramas that are very inspirational. And I think, yeah, Ada just had that same kind of deal where she's, you know, she just would make so many just very well thought out tweets on Twitter. And you're just like, you know, you're just smarter than the average bear. You know, you really are.
Yeah. And I feel like she really made that connection with the young actors, especially like in the interviews that I was watching, they would always say like, you know, Ava would, just when I thought I couldn't like push any more emotion out, she challenged me and I gave even more and kept going and kept going. So like, you know, she really wanted to bring that true emotion into this whole, like, into each and every episode. So she's, she obviously knows what she's doing, you know?
Absolutely. I hadn't seen A Wrinkle in Time, but I'm sure it was a fine kids movie for what it was. It seemed like a lot of people who hated it were just not fans of kids movies or...
Yeah, and I haven't seen it either. Like, they forced us to read the book in high school, and I was, I couldn't understand it. So I was like, I'm not going to watch the movie either because I probably won't get it.
But at the same time, like, I could tell that it was a progressive, very well-done movie because virtually all the people hating on it were, like, neo-Nazis making a lot of anti, you know, feminist remarks. I'm like, okay, so it's probably a very well-done, you know, kids movie. It's like,
aren't they always?
Regardless of whether it's entertaining or not, if you got just very positive energy, that should be commended regardless of whether or not you find it entertaining. So it's like, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like reading reviews on this show, and there was a few that were like raunchy. Like, you could tell they were like, you know,
this makes people feel good. How dare they?
Yeah.
And it doesn't have any violence. Like,
and some of them were like, she didn't even like give notice to the other victims, like, you know, the woman who was raped, and there was like other joggers in the park that night, or there were other crimes going on and there were other victims. I'm like, okay, but like, that's not the point of this
whole thing.
That's
not even remotely the story. It's about the Central Park Five. If I have to retitle my movie The Central Park Five just for you to pay attention to what it's about, then you're just not ready to listen.
Yeah, exactly. And they gave it like 1-star review. I'm like, you don't even know what you're talking about. And they were like, Ava didn't even get some of the facts right. There were 6 men who were, you know, arrested.
It reminded me of when they talked about like the O.J. Simpson true crime documentaries. They're like, they got some stuff wrong. Like, you do realize they're sorting through a very convoluted case. Yeah, you know,
exactly.
Same kind of deal. Although you can say in that thing, yeah, a lot of people, O.J. wasn't, you know, indicted, but at the same time, a lot of people thought, you know, pretty much agreed that he was a pretty sketchy, not cool dude. So it's just like, and it's just another example of kind of like Rittenhouse, where it's just like the case was not well put together. It was very heavy-handed with how it was presented. And at the same time, you got a very, you know, a person who everyone agrees is, you know, guilty on trial.
Yeah.
Most
yeah,
everyone.
Yeah, exactly. And he got lucky on that one because of his judge that he had. But,
yeah. And it really is amazing how many will just believe, you know, just whatever facts are presented, like there's only one portion of the argument that should be considered. And it's just like, oh, and if you get off, you're a good person. I'm like, not necessarily. You could just have had a weak case. Or
yeah. And have you ever been on a jury before?
I've had a few family members who have. My grandmother, for one, like, I remember she got dismissed when she, I think this was in the 80s or 90s, when she was asked an opinion. I know my mother definitely got dismissed immediately because she wasn't answering it simply like, you know, the lawyer was asking for. And she's like,
yeah,
well, I don't think the guy is guilty, but I would like to see a little more evidence. And they weren't too keen on that.
Yeah, exactly. And I was just recently, like a few months ago, actually, for the first time I was on a jury. And it was like a week long too. And some guy, it was a black man, and he, you know, allegedly committed first degree murder. And when I was looking at the evidence, I was like, something's off there. You know, I know that not all the evidence is submitted. So just in the back of my head, I was like, I don't know if I can do this. I really don't know. But and it's probably a downfall that I know that too, because I feel like, you know, my friends and like people close to me, they don't know the things that I know because I'm into true crime. You know, I know quite a few cases. So, you know, I know how people can get wrongly convicted the way these five men were. So it really was rough.
Is amazing how, and then it's like often when someone does the whole reasonable doubt, it's just because it seems like they just want someone to not be ruled as, you know, guilty, but just that one exception. I'm like, well, you got to be consistent. If you're going to just do it with just these, then you got to apply that to any kind of rule thing. No, it doesn't deserve the same amount. Yes, it does. Everything deserves the same amount, but it really is hard, especially when people are just letting their emotions kind of dictate what they're saying. And so for those who know about the Central Park Five, you may know that, again, it was five boys who were scooped up at the scene of a crime, and some of them were beaten up quite brutally and essentially forced to confess. And there's been other just restatements of this and that here and there. And it's even more interesting how, you know, several times, and, you know, it's also documented here. It was very intriguing how, again, they didn't have much of a plan, and they were able to get many to just like disregard the fact that there was no, you know, semen collected at the so-called rape. And the victim was blind, but yet strongly believed, you know, despite being beat up and everything, they gotta be the ones. If you didn't see your attacker, how can you very well say they are the attacker?
That was the thing for me. There was no DNA match to any of the guys, so, you know, that really threw me for a loop. And for me, you know, as a juror, that would cause reasonable doubt for me. But, and the other thing was, one of the young boys, and you put that well, because they were boys. They were like
so damn young.
14 to like 15, all underage, all minors.
And it made me just so sad, because, you know, there's just so many people who, whether they're bigoted or just very open-minded people who, again, the minute you get smeared on the front cover of a newspaper, you know, the damage is done. Yeah. And everyone's like, well, they must have done something bad. I mean, they made it that far into the newspaper.
Yeah, exactly. And
these kids, good for nothing kids, they were up to something. And people just don't seem to realize, when you're in a big ass city, you know, it's just people are walking about and minding their own business, and they're not responsible for if a crime happens in their neighborhood.
Yeah, I know. And like,
especially in an infamous, you know, park that's in New York.
Yeah, exactly. And like, during it, I was like, why is this woman going out at 9 p.m. at night to go for a jog? You know, it's like, I understand.
I see it all the time too, and I never understand it, because nothing good ever happens at night. And it's just like, if you're going to be out and about, at least be driving in a car, you know, do a quick errand at a 24/7 grocery store. Don't.
I mean, you're going to be doing this in like New York City, Central Park. Like, I understand there's probably lots of people around, but I don't know. It's like, and it's sad too, because as women, you know, we can't do those things. Like, we can't go out at night and go for a jog.
My folks were very strict with me, because my sister and I were going to the same college, and they're like, wherever you go, keep Meredith in viewpoint. And it's just like, keep your sister in viewpoint. There might be an assault on your campus. Doesn't matter how many security guards or police are on there. You know, I was just like, I totally understand.
Yeah, exactly. And I forgot what kind of job she had. So it probably, you know, was the only time she could fit in a job. I mean, a jog.
I didn't recall much on there too. And I saw some people, even some right-wing critics, complaining, oh, we didn't see much about the victim. I'm like, well, there never really was much detail about the victim. And yeah, it's not the perspective of the victim. So
yeah, because these five men were victims of the justice system. So yeah.
We don't give a fuck about everybody else. We give a fuck about how they got out of this. And I've seen other people complain in just other docudramas, like various war and disaster movies, like when they show real life people matching it up with like the existing people. I thought this was very well done here in the final episodes. Like, they really did good at just showing the actual guys just walking around and how they're now community leaders. And
yeah, I did too. And they all have like the one, I think it's Yusuf. I think that's his name.
I believe so. Yes, Yusuf.
Yeah, and he has like 10 kids now. Towards the end, I saw that. I was like, wow. And he's like he had plenty of education afterwards, and he's written plenty of books, and, you know, he really made it out for himself after this, you know, despite the fact of what he went through and everything like that. So it was just really interesting. But.
Oh, totally. And, so I did a little digging on filmmaker DeVarney, and I was really impressed. I had not a clue that she worked in like marketing and PR entertainment, because she had been a journalist and she actually covered the O.J. Simpson murder trial.
Really?
She became very disillusioned, she claims, and moved into, you know, PR, and then was a junior publicist at 20th Century Fox and a few other agencies. I'm like, that's fucking awesome. And she formed her own DeVarney agency in 1999.
You go, girl. Fox.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you go, girl. And yeah, she, I think she's made it, in all honesty, because I Will Follow has all, and Middle of Nowhere have already been played on Turner Classic Movies. That alone tells you you've made it.
Yeah, exactly.
One best dramatic film at Sundance. She just has a very good just way of just really just making everything just feel just so natural without just being very preachy or just self-indulgent.
Yeah.
She's just so organized, and I'd even go so far as to say she's the Black Spielberg. She's just really like female Spielberg for that matter. And
yeah. She really is, though. And I feel like in the future, we're going to see plenty more from her, and it's all going to be amazing. Like, that's my feeling I have.
Oh, totally. And I think the fact that Selma got denied just, you know, much diversity Oscars is kind of like how I was when I was talking about the TV show Power not getting any Emmys. Is just the lack of diversity is going to keep being some political you know, topic for the award shows. So it is kind of interesting how you like to think they're very progressive, and yet half the time they don't really, you know, talk about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of even more sad that the most biggest, you know, minority themed movie that got a lot of awards attention was a superhero movie, you know, Black Panther. I'm like, well, that's fine, but why can't it be an actual, like, historically significant or work of fiction that is very dramatically, you know, rewarding? And it just seems like unless you sugarcoat it with a lot of effects and I don't know, is based on some kind of sci-fi thing. I mean, there's already a bunch of action and horror movies that get accused of being denied a proper venue for award ceremonies. Yeah. But yeah, it seems like if you make just other stuff that hits so close to home, like people are just like, oh, I don't even want to talk about that unless there's like a great, you know, A-list actor in it.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, people don't want to talk about this, you know, this case that went on. And I mean, that's why a lot of us haven't heard of it, you know, but that's probably why not a ton of awards were given for this, because people avoid it. You know, they do their best to avoid the conversation and to keep their eyes shut to it, you know, and it's really sad, honestly. But yeah, I just hope like the next thing she makes will, you know, I really hope she makes another like true crime kind of like series, because she did very well. So
oh, totally. And I think she's made a lot of good like close calls. Like, she was thinking of doing like a DC superhero movie and even a biography on Prince, and she, I think, left both of those because of creative differences, and I think it was just because she's like, I can do better. I can something that is so much more significant than about, you know, something easy, like, you know, again, a comic book adaptation or a selfish celebrity. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, a few others. I mean, her show Queen Sugar has a primary character about who's a convicted felon whose prison past makes it difficult for him to find a job, and I think she just wanted to keep exploring themes like that.
Mm-hmm.
I heard so much good stuff about it, but I haven't seen it yet.
I haven't either, but I need to.
It's on Netflix.
If she did so good with this, I need to see everything else she's made.
Right. Totally. So, how would you contrast this? Like, I saw that not only Oprah produced this, but also Robert De Niro and Jane Rosenthal. Why do I know that name? Okay. So she's part of the Tribeca Enterprises. So there you go. She's worked with a lot of stuff with Robert De Niro. Okay.
Oh, gotcha.
But yeah, I mean, I definitely heard about the settlement in 2014, but it was so bad how it had been going on. The settlement had a wrongful conviction went on since 2003. So I'm just like, that's two decades. That's not good.
I know. And I agree. And like,
and they already had to serve time back in, you know, like decades before. So it's like, man.
And like no amount of money can change taking away someone's childhood. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was just heartbreaking. Like, that was the heartbreaking aspect of it. And all the interviews that I watched of them, that's the main thing they wanted to point out was like, fuck the money, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we lost our childhood and we went through hell because not like with the whole prison, the prison ladder, I guess you could say, is like rape is one of the worst crimes you can do in prison because you will get a beat down. It's like really neck and neck with pedophilia. And that's what one of the guys kept saying, you know, and it's like, we went through hell because of what we were accused of. And it's like, no amount of money can change that. And
yeah,
you know,
and the damage is gone when there's a smearing. And so I find it so funny how, once again, Fairstein, and a bunch of these other associates, are taking DeVarney and Netflix to court. Claiming there's a non-factual assertions about their interrogation techniques, and she did a whole defamation lawsuit. I'm like, well, come on. You already broke these people's, you know, personas and ruined their lives. It's like, I think we can ruin your life. You made money.
Yeah, exactly. You've made plenty of money. You can go into hiding if you want to, but like, I mean, like, that's the thing though, you know, this ruined their lives because now, even though they were found, you know, they were exonerated or whatever, they still are looked at as if they did, you know, the raping. And
I mean, really, they used a Ken Burns documentary, for God's sakes. You can't say this is biased.
Exactly. So you can't tell me otherwise, you know.
It was really also just unfathomable, but just very intriguing how, you know, Blair Underwood's character, you know, he had no experience in, you know, criminal justice. He was just only a divorce attorney.
Yeah.
That was just mind blowing to me. Is like, again, their resources were limited and had nothing to work with, really.
Yeah. And that still goes on today, you know, and it's really sad. I feel like I'm not sure if there's any, like nonprofits out there that I think there are a few, but I don't know any of them that can help pay for attorneys for people who were falsely accused. And
it's a good question if they've changed it up or not. And it does make you, like you say, want to research a bunch of other dilemmas with the justice system, because it's not as simple as, you know, dealing with a speeding ticket. You know, it's dealing with,
yeah, exactly. And like, even after they were found guilty, you know, the parents, you really saw that struggle throughout the episodes. And I mean, they could hardly afford their attorneys, so they were like scraping up pennies, and some of them were trying to send money to their sons in prison, but it's like, I can't afford you because I'm still trying to pay off these attorney fees. So it's just an ongoing problem even till this day.
Yeah. And I mean, this was before social media where you could, you know, say, hey, yeah, everybody help out, I got a problem, yeah, I need it dealt with, you know, can you,
yeah, there were no GoFundMe accounts. I was just about to say.
There was no, can you just, you know, donate, you know?
Yeah, no, there was none of that back then, unfortunately.
Oh man. It was even hard to even find just certain stuff about it without finding like it being just editorials. So it's definitely an interesting case to review and look at. And it is kind of interesting how it's just so many are just still adamant that they must have been guilty. And it's just like, well, I mean, if you're going by crappy paperwork, then sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And in another review that I was reading, they were like, it wasn't, you know, said in the docuseries, but like one of the young men, they had details to the crime that, you know, the police didn't even give to them. Yeah. And I'm like, you know, I highly doubt that. You know, when you go back and you look at their police interviews, the thing is that a lot of it is trimmed as well. So you're not seeing what the police officers are telling them or coercing them to say.
They do so good with the montage, though, of what everyone's being fed and how they might have had various variations of the threat. And I think it's also just timing's everything. And it definitely came out of the right time when we're already, you know, we've had so many Black Lives Matter protests and everything, but the last few years have been even more rickety rockety, you know.
Yeah, because everything's finally coming to light.
Totally. People are now finally saying, oh, well, now I got to show what end of the aisle I'm on. I can't tell you how many neighborhoods I pass with the whole, you know, defund or I support the police. And it's just like, it's now gotten to that time where it's just like, there's just no other way to say it, because however you say it, just everyone knows what they support, and they'll either do it out of stubbornness or because they actually believe in the cause. And I think it's just very interesting how, I mean, for years, police have gotten in trouble and they've either, you know, been fired or been on paid leave. And I think it's, you know, this did a good job of just kind of hinting at police unions, you know, revisiting this and finding it questionable, you know. And it is very wild how they asked the coroner or the one of the other just evidence guys who was just like, yeah, no, that doesn't match the report at all. Because it wasn't. There's no evidence.
Exactly. There's no DNA match or any evidence of that. And like, I mean, like, I just recently did a case, the yogurt shop murders, where there were tons of people. It's where like four girls were raped and murdered, and then the whole place was set on fire. It's a very terrible case, but it, even till this day, it's still a cold case because no one's been able to find, you know, the killers. And they accused like four men of doing it, four white men, but still, it's, you know, the police corruption, the amount of police corruption in that case is ridiculous. Like, one of the guys, I think his name is Michael Scott, during his police interview, the policeman was, or the detective was like hitting his arm and like really hounding down, like, you know what happened, tell us what happened. And he's like, I have no clue. And then the detective brings in a gun And he's like, do you recognize this? And he's like, no, I don't. And he literally presses it up against the back of Michael's head. And he's like, how about now? And Michael's like, nope, Jesus. Not a clue. You know, it's like, that still goes on. So it's just...
Have you heard of the Chicago cases kind of doing a lot of similar stuff like that, where they're still, like, giving, like, it's kind of like with how certain Native Americans can get free college. They would do a lot of money for those wrongly convicted years ago, like in the 70s. But yeah, it is the same kind of deal, like just disgruntled, hard-boiled detectives. And this isn't an entertaining movie in any way. You know, this is real life. They just kind of get someone to confess until they just finally give up and say, fine, you broke me. I'll sign whatever it is. And it's just like, that's not doing your job. You know, find someone else who isn't, you know, even if they're a liar, they're still not your person.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And in this whole show, in the first episode, you see what the young boys went through. Like, they were practically getting beaten up. And
make sure you get them home. I'm like, they're not going to get home.
Exactly. And that's the only reason why they lied, is because they just wanted to go home. They were petrified. They were 14 years old, some of them.
Everyone was so a kid. Like, and what did you do? You fibbed?
Yes. And except one of them, he had like a bus card, I think, and it said he was 16, and he only made it that way to like impress girls or whatever, to show that he was older. And the cops were like, yeah, sure. So even though he was really 15, so he was a minor. And so he was brought in for questioning without a parent. And it's like, that case, honestly, or at least his trial, should have been appealed completely because of that. But it never was. And then
he should have gotten a bunch of a big payday out of all of them. Because this is like, this is more than just slander and just false imprisonment. This is also just, for lack of a better word, it's just, it's pretty much a life ender. It's not a career ender just a reason for me to rot. This is basically if we just flat out can't, you know, function as any individuals, we're just rotting. Even if we're not in a cell, we're rotting.
Yeah, exactly. And like, speaking of cell and rotting, when it came to Corey Wise, you know, in like episode 4, when he was in solitary for I don't know how long, it never said.
That was
said,
a good deal. But I was very surprised that they went that route, but I wasn't sure at first, but they did a good job just connecting the dots there as it went on, where you're just like, oh wow.
Yeah, because he was the only one out of the 5 who was sent to adult prison first when he was only 16 years old.
Out of all of them, yeah.
And charged with rape. So when you're charged with rape, it's not a good time in prison, you know. So he's getting beaten to death practically, and then he asks for solitary confinement, and he's like practically losing his mind. And you know, there's even studies shown today that solitary is not the way to go for prison. No. Like, it will mess you up mentally. And you can, I hate to say this, but you can kind of tell compared to the other men now, like Corey Wise is a little different, and I can tell that he really went through some emotional trauma and a lot. I'm sure he's probably in therapy now, you know, getting the help that he needs after what, you know, he's been through. But
oh yeah, when you see him getting dragged away, you know, on all fours, you're just like,
I know.
He's not good.
So I was really glad she kind of made a whole episode on Corey, because he really did go through a lot, you know.
Right. Everyone else, you know, kept getting appeals, and it's like, well,
yeah,
he didn't have that on his side.
Yeah. And they offered him parole, but he kept denying it, because in order to get parole, he had to admit to what he'd done and like take blame for it practically. And he kept denying, and right up until the end, until, you know, someone confessed, and that's when they all got released. So luckily he didn't confess to it, you know, air quotes, because, you know, he didn't do it. But, you know, it's like towards the end of the whole series, you're in the end, you're really proud of him for sticking it out, you know, after all he went through.
Sticking to his guns.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very uncanny with how they went about it, and they made such good use of every episode. I never found one where you're like, that's filler, or that doesn't need to go there, or that confused me with how you placed it. Yeah, they were on their game, and participant media apparently has done plenty of other, you know, true life stuff like Judas and the Black Messiah and Spotlight. Yeah. So I can see why this was in their interest to say, hey, let's take this on. Let's do it.
Yeah. And honestly, I'm still surprised they fit it into 4 episodes. I feel like, I don't think it was like crammed or rushed at all. I think it was very well placed in each episode. But I know there's like more to this case as well. And they probably could have done an episode on like what really went on that night, because there was like 25 men in Central Park that were going around and doing crimes. And I think the part that was confusing for me a little bit was how they chose these 5 men, or these 5 boys, out of all 25 people who were out that night. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't know.
No, that's a good point, because I mean, you can only go about it just so many different ways. And if you I'm sure if they tried that way, they would have been unable to get, you know, every portrayal down to a T, or even have some kind of coherent movie. And like you say, you know, time's not on everyone's side, and I'm sure they said.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, 25, that is pretty bad. But yeah, but, that's very well said, because I mean, we've seen so many other true life stuff that's been so heavily documented to where people are like even sticklers for how certain stuff gets dramatized with the court cases or how stuff is revealed, and it's like, you know, you only have time for so much stuff, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, honestly, I think it did a good job on portraying what was going on outside of the court before the court proceedings even happened, because I think it was like episode 1 or 2 in the very, it had to be episode 2 in the beginning, when they're trying to set up this case to be presented, and they're trying to like tweak the timeline for it to fit for these 5 boys to be at the crime scene. I'm like, can they do that? Like, I wonder if that actually goes on, because I haven't really heard of a case where, you know, the police department will like kind of tweak the timeline a little bit. But I was like, wow, they really did that, because obviously it wouldn't be in the series if it didn't happen. So honestly, I didn't look for any articles about it, but, you know, I kind of believed what I was watching. So, and I'm sure it happened, you know, them falsely tweaking the timeline.
And even if certain people in the audience chamber didn't yell, you know, that's not true, they might have still done, you know, and there's nothing that feels like it's an overblown, you know, Hallmark production. There's never bad performances in this. And fun fact, I didn't realize that Participant Media also produced the very extremely similar true life legal drama, Just Mercy. Did you ever see that one?
I don't think so. What is it about?
So Michael B. Jordan played lawyer Brian Stevenson, who had to overturn a man who had been not only wrongfully convicted of murder, but it was a case that involved a judicial override where the judge wanted a death penalty, but the jury wanted, you know, life imprisonment. It launched the career of Destin Daniel Kraton, who has recently done a bunch of stuff like Shang-Chi and everything. But it was another one of those, that movie wasn't as interesting, but it was definitely well acted and an intriguing thing that made me say, you know what, I'm gonna look up the real life case. And yeah. Hopefully this, you know, the show does the same, you know, people keep talking about it because it had been just mentioned here and there. And, you know, we'd seen this attorney just step down, and I'm just never, ever really surprised when I just see certain people who are admired in the public eye, and then they just are on record just saying a very petty comment, and it can happen to anyone. And I'm just never, just nothing really surprises me anymore. It really doesn't.
No, same. It's all political. It's all about power. Like, that's kind of how this whole case went too. It's like, it's all about political power. And that's why they wanted to at least accuse somebody of doing the rape, because they would look like heroes, you know, in the media's eye, at least. And it's just really sad because that still goes on today. So.
Totally. So Chris Bowers did the score for this show. His credits include Green Book, Bridgerton, and Space Jam 2, as well as the TV version of Dear White People. So. I was really impressed by the small kind of piano cues in this, because they really, it doesn't feel like someone trying to copy like Hans Zimmer or John Williams for the bit of time. It really kind of complemented the mood. And there were times where it was just kind of slowly, I don't know if you noticed it, it would slowly kind of fade into the background and then kind of fade out. Like the voices are getting louder when they're yelling, and then slowly the yells kind of, you know, fade out and the score starts getting bigger. I saw that of like three different times at small moments. I was like, that's interesting.
Yeah, right. And I think I read somewhere, do you remember when the boys were convicted of being guilty, and that scene, like right after it happened, there was one of the boys who was playing a trumpet. Do you remember that? He was like sitting in a chair in the middle of the street. It was kind of,
I believe, like, so around episode 2-ish. Yeah.
And it's like, I saw online where it's the significant of that was about, you know, because he's a trumpet player, he wanted to play for like some college and band, and he's kind of playing his trumpet to be like, you know, wake up America, this just happened, kind of thing. But that was kind of the symbolic meaning behind that. But that was really the only kind of music thing I really paid attention to.
No, it's fine. There was plenty of times, especially when it starts out very raw, and you know, you're seeing in the father who tells his, you know, one of the kids to, you know, his son to, you know, whose trial he didn't even go to. And I loved how they kind of took a little free license with that. He just was never there for the son. And I was like, yeah, I can see if he coerced him to go along with it, that he probably felt guilty and he just was better off not being in his life. But
Have you seen the interviews of him towards his father for not being there and like leaving his mother while he was in jail? Like, he still gets upset about it, and he's like, no,
my would father be too. I'd be like, you abandoned me.
Yeah, you told me to lie, and that's why I'm here.
Here's a 20 for the cab. I don't need a 20 for the cab. Exactly. I need you in the cab, you know, telling me everything's going to be all right. I'm sorry I told you this was the right decision to do, you know, fess up to it.
Yeah. So, I mean, overall, his father kind of ruined his life. You know, I can see how he has some hard feelings towards him, even
totally,
you know, after getting out and everything. So, that part was really hard for me, and because towards, I think, like episode 3 or something, when you see him get out of prison and his dad is very sick, like he came back into the family, the mom accepted him back, and he's like practically dying, and at the end, they don't really talk at all, but it's just sad because the dad wanted to explain his reasoning, blah, blah, blah. I don't think that's really too good of a reasoning for leaving the family.
It's like nothing was going to be good enough.
Yeah, exactly. And it was just really sad. Like, I cried when I saw the dad practically taking his last breath and then his son crying over him, because it's like, I missed out on a lot, you know, but he still had so much hatred towards his father. So I don't know. That made me emotional.
It was interesting. It really was. And I, you know, there's, you know, this wasn't a matter of, you know, I'm not in your life because I cheated on your mom or anything. It's just a matter of I'm not here because I'm just not here.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just that rare, just inexplicable. And you never feel like you're getting a sugar-coated half-assed version of the story. And it just felt like they essentially just, you know, someone went for just several newspaper clippings and talked to some professors or something and just said, you know, this is what we got. This is how we're going to communicate it. And go from there.
Yeah. And I mean, the whole movie was like an emotional roller coaster. So towards the end, right as I got done with it, I'm like, I am very depressed right now. I need to go like watch something happy because I feel, I felt shame.
I was the same way. Yeah.
It was just like, I have to watch like Rick and Morty or something right now just to have some upbeat emotions.
Totally. This is something to cheer us up. So I did some digging on the cinematographer because this is a damn well shot show. Yes, Bradford Young has previously shot for, again, Ava on Selma, and you have seen his cinematography on just about everything. Just Mother of George, Pawn Sacrifice, and 2016's Arrival. Also seen him do just easygoing stuff like, you know, the Star Wars Han Solo movie. Oh, and he shot Pariah, which I mentioned earlier. So, yeah, he's working with the best of the best independent filmmakers.
That makes sense. I mean, every scene was well shot. Like, I can't complain about anything, honestly. It each shot captured every emotion. And, I mean, I don't know. I give it 5 stars all around. I really do.
It really was. In a 2012 New York Times article, it states that he favors raw light and has a penchant for shooting into it, but ultimately focuses on getting out of the way. I'm like, that's cool. And
yeah,
because yeah, the way this is shot, I can tell instead of the day for night, you know, type of dilemma. I don't know how they do it and everything, but yeah, I feel like for all I know, it could have been actual at night and they just did some creative tricks. But I see that he had shot just all this other stuff with many different filmmakers and music videos, and I was just like, this is perfect, because there's so many cinematographers who would have just focused on making everything beautiful but not believable, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
like that's exactly. Fine if that's the point of the movie, but
yeah, and I mean, I can agree with that. Like I felt it. I felt like everything was very raw, especially in each interview, you know, of the boys, the police interviews. I was like, wow, this lighting right now, you know, you really feel like you're there, honestly, with them. And
yeah. No like voyeurism, even. That's an often done angle. And here, I feel like I'm just here sitting right next to them. That there's not even all that much steady cam or shaky cam, really, unless people are walking into the courtroom. But for the most, even when they do like slow motion shots, and, you know, as typical with any historical drama, you know, music starts playing. But like, it just feels, it's such a differently done natural edit as opposed to, you know, the slow motion, you know, yelling, no, you know, it's more,
I know.
The way this is done here is like, there's no reason for anyone to unintentionally guffaw at finding a cheesy edit here. This is just so well accomplished.
Yeah. And that's how I felt.
Just perfectly assembled. Just like, okay, that they definitely storyboarded this or had some shot list going, because you can tell when people make shit up.
Yeah, that's the thing. You really can. And I feel like throughout this, there was no, like, I don't know. I did feel like the whole thing was raw. Like, no really special effects or anything like that. It's like, all right, we're about to take this right now. Get ready, action kind of thing. And boom.
Even
like,
not even typical heavier, you know, trumpet or even electronic music was even all that used all that much from what I can
exactly.
remember. It was kind of just not even trumpets to signify something, you know, for whom the bell tolls or tragic. None of that even here.
Yeah, I know. And I think that's what really made it easier to capture the emotion for the audience. You know, I think it that played into a big part of this whole movie, so, or this whole series.
It really was unlike most of what we've seen, because I mean, with this, I mean, there's so many other miniseries that, you know, love to go on and on and on, and I mean, you know, they were groundbreaking in their own respective right, regardless of how they were edited for syndication or home video use. But yeah, this, I mean, they pretty much had it all squared away. They just made a Netflix deal and Netflix allowed them this freedom to pretty much pursue because people are looking for true life stories. Cause again, they can care about all the, you know, money and awards they'll receive, but you know, when it really does mean a lot when you can actually tell some kind of story that has some kind of, not just a true crime angle, but also just reminds many of just how fortunate they are to have not had to face just such dire circumstances where, you know, everything is threatened and perceptions about them are faced time and again.
Yeah, exactly. And with everything going on, you know, nowadays with Black Lives Matter and everything, I think it's important to kind of revisit cases like this and show like, hey, this is similar to like Trayvon Martin, George Floyd.
I'm glad you bring up Trayvon, because people will remember the name, but like sometimes I have to remind people, Zimmerman, you know, this is the guy who went about and did this and that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, it's important to bring up the past because it shows that nothing's really changed at all.
No, I've even tried to convince people to do a few like true crime, like reenactment kind of movies, and no one was comfortable. And it was like, really? Like back when I was working on independent film projects, and it was just amazing how everyone was fine with playing a bad guy, but only if it was like fictional or they didn't do anything besides like do a fight scene or something. I'm like, you got to be comfortable. You know, I had a friend who literally does look like Zimmerman. And I was just like, we could do a pretty good true crime anthology and just show about stories that affected today's society. But he was just like, no, why would I want to play that? I'd be glamorizing him. Like, you're not glamorizing him. You would be just doing a, just get inside the psyche of how shitty people think they can keep getting away with endless money and feel no remorse. But it's hard to tell people that too. You know, it's kind of like when you got violent or sexual content in a movie and having to tell people the tone or how it's used or whether it's entertainment or art, you know, it's just so hard to do, you know? And I would get that too. I would see people say, well, I'll do this violent thing as long as I don't have to do bloody makeup, or I'll do the sex as long as it's not pornographic. It's like, well,
they're not up for the challenge. I see.
Just do what you signed up to do and leave it at that.
Wow. See, it all depends on how you really portray the characters, because
the pitch is everything.
And there's a lot of people who glamorize serial killers nowadays, like Ted Bundy.
I'm so done with Ted Bundy.
Don't even get me started. There's a new movie out about him on Hulu, and I just watched it. I'm like, I hate this. I was like 2 minutes in, I'm like, I already hate it. It was a terrible movie. But
is that the one with what's his name, Efron or whatever?
No, so that one was a little bit better.
Okay.
But I forgot the actor.
But I know what you mean, where it's just like there are a lot, so many subjects that have been revisited and
yeah,
having to wade through the various thing. And there are times where I'm just like, I feel like you have portrayed this person so much to where it doesn't matter what your intent is. You glamorize them to the point of where the fact that you want to revisit it means you already kind of have some unofficial fascination with them, which is not good.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And like, they don't even, even to this day, I have not seen like a movie or documentary that hasn't shown the whole story around, like, say, Ted Bundy, because, you know, his wife at the time got the short end of a stick, and like, not a lot of people go into her and her side of the story, because she wrote a whole book and everything and said how, you know, Bundy was really abusive towards her and everything. But you miss that part in these movies and documentaries because
yeah,
they just show all about him and his psyche and everything. So
everyone wants to concentrate on the illicit affairs and everything. I'm like, yeah, so this sounds like a sleazy B picture. It really shouldn't even be adapted anymore.
Exactly. And like with this, with When They See Us, the show, I think they did a great job of not like glamorizing the actual rapist and, you know, who admitted towards the end, or even, you know, glamorizing the media or anything like that. They were really just mainly focused on these five men.
And so I'm really even impressed not only at how these actors are going to keep getting a bunch of different, you know, collaborations and future projects, but you know, they're going to pick something that really is pretty well thought out and stays with you in a way. Like Frank Pondo played, you know, Detective Gonzalez. He was excellent, but he was barely on screen, but he left an impression. So I'm sure he'll get plenty of other intimidating or dramatically rewarding roles. Isis King, transgender actress who played Corey's sister, you know, who was transgendered in real life. I thought that was a good casting, you know, because that's a pretty sensitive role to cast.
Yep. And I wasn't even expecting that, you know, him having a transgender sister, and she actually got murdered towards the end while he was in jail. And that broke me, you know, just when I thought I couldn't be any more broken, it went ahead and chopped me up. Like it was
really sad. That and he has to find it out while he's suffering. And it's just like,
yeah. And it's just that. And also I kind of like that aspect of it too. They're kind of bringing in another, minority group of Black transgender people. And I could really appreciate that. Like, they're kind of showing how back then, how it was for transgender people. And I loved it. I was like, yes, like, please show this, you know, because even to this day, it's still the same, you know, especially for Black transgender lives, you know, it's
definitely. Her IMDb claims she travels the country speaking to young adults at colleges about self-love and living in the truth of your existence. I think that's part of the situation that isn't even really talked about enough. You know, just how do you become comfortable in your new skin, so to speak, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And they show, you know, scenes of obviously her mother not accepting it and kicking her out of the house, and then she has to leave her brother behind. And it really shows that raw sense to how it truly is for a majority of people, you know, transitioning like that. So, God, especially in the 80s.
Oh, totally. After a while, I did kind of just, I'm glad you brought that up. I would have totally flaked and forgot about that because, you know, you're just so overwhelmed by all the other just depressing material. But see, okay, so for those who are listening, yes, this isn't an easy thing. Split up however you got to. But at the end of the day, you're also going to be happy that you saw this because you're not going to feel like this was, you know, a story anyone could have told that was even necessarily easy to talk about, you know, and to even just interpret such a thing that, you know, is such a convoluted crime case. It's like, at the end of the day, you just feel so rewarded that someone had the guts to want to tell something that is just so heart-wrenching. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I feel like, you know, thank God they put this in the series, because it needs to be brought up and it needs to be discussed about. And for
anyone else would have just been like, oh, irrelevant. No, it's relevant because it's talking about, you know.
Yeah, it's very relevant, you know, and Corey Wise loved his sister, you know, who was originally a man but transitioned into a woman. And
siblings stick around, you know, and support siblings.
Exactly. And like, you know, and to even in my own family, we feel that, you know, like me and my brother are gay and we're very supportive of each other. My whole family is supportive, you know. Not every family is the same though, but it needs to be discussed, and people who keep their eyes closed and avoid the conversation, well, they're part of the problem, you know, of today's society. And that's kind of what I also bring into my own podcast, where I talk about gay news in the beginning of each podcast episode, because it needs to be a normal conversation. Like, it needs to be talked about more often so people can gradually become more used to it and it can become a normalized thing, you know, subject matter.
Oh, totally. So, another true crime podcast you guys might like, A Few Bad Apples, which talks about police misconduct. And then at the end, she'll talk about a brief, you know, police story that was a highlight, that where someone wasn't a bad apple.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's so hard to kind of pan it out and actually kind of keep the momentum, because, you know, covering these stories is already just so, you know, time consuming and, again, heartbreaking. And so then to actually have to organize your thoughts, say it coherently, and then, you know, tell everyone, yeah, hey, this is a big deal, we should keep discussing it.
Yeah. And the thing is that a lot of people don't talk about these things because they're afraid to, and they're afraid of being ridiculed or shut down. But the thing is, it's okay to ask questions. It's okay to have this conversation with people, as long as you take the initiative to do your own research, because in the Black community, it's not their job to teach us what things are going on right now and how you should understand our problems that are going on. It's up to us to do our own research and, you know, realize what's going on. So I feel like, luckily, you know, Ava did this series amazingly and really brought to light a lot of issues, but it's up to us to really research further into that. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, can't be commended enough, because, I mean, sure, you know, they made a big giant production and, you know, casted a reasonable amount of unknowns and semi-known character actors, but, you know, this couldn't have happened overnight. You know, nothing happens overnight. To get this funded and tell someone you have a vision and I have permission or I have proper documents to, you know, adapt this, you know, from script to screen, from newspaper articles to a coherent screenplay, you know, that's just so time consuming. And I think, as you've already well stated, this is a show that will, I think, probably even be, I can imagine someone wanting to show it in a film class or even just some kind of history class. Maybe people can, it'd be interesting to know if someone studied it at a law school. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, I know. I'd like to hear if anyone's done that in law school, because I also feel like this really should be, you know, taught or like demonstrated in high school. Like, it should be shown the way, because when I was in high school, we watched the movie The Freedom Riders.
Oh, okay, and, nice.
Yeah, and that was a really huge importance and kind of, you know, woke us up even in high school. But this would be amazing for young students to kind of watch and understand what's going on today. You know, I think that's really important,
because there are a lot of that's another movie that just kind of just got forgotten in the shumble.
Yeah,
it was
exactly.
Like, it was produced by MTV, for God's sakes, and no one talks about it.
No, it was really good. It was a really good movie, too. You know, sometimes I'll still watch it from time to time. But
it's hard to even just find the movie that is more than just like a crowd pleaser that really does make you say, hey, you know, I didn't just watch something entertaining. I learned something. And
yeah,
it seems like I just never fail to just see an increase. And a lot of people are like, it's not going to make me cry. Is it? Oh, it's not going to make me have to think too hard. Is it like, why do you even want to watch something if your brain's not somewhat engaged with it? You know, it's just,
yeah, exactly. Like, go watch Fox News if you want that, you know?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I like stupid entertainment, but after a while I get bored nowadays, even more so, because I'm not a kid anymore. I want to actually be very involved with something.
Yeah. And for people who like aren't familiar with the justice system and everything, and they'll watch this series, they'll probably be like, what, there's no way this happens, or like, there's no way there's police corruption this bad. But there is. There's a lot that goes on even today, so just keep that in mind for people who watch this.
Well, it's been so great having you on here. Thank you ever so much for making it.
Yeah, I know. But
any other stuff you want to promote for on the road? Like what you'll be covering in the future? Or...
I'm not going to lie. I'm probably going to cover this case because I think it's important to kind of reiterate everything that went on and, you know, the real case that went on behind it. But I'll probably do that pretty recently too, because I don't know, it's very interesting. I'm excited to do it too. But so everyone stay tuned for that.
Woo! Okay, Stellar, well, you have a safe rest of 2022.
Yes, thank you, and be safe, don't get COVID.
Any mutation of it is not in my interest to get. I'm even having to tell certain people stop trying to shake my hand or, you know, give me knocks. I don't even do elbows anymore. Just
really
suffice. Don't get close to me, please.
Yeah, it's fine. Even like besides COVID, I'm like that too. Like, don't touch me. Don't get close to me. Oh God.
Oh man. Okay, let me access the Zoom. What the hell? Come on, computer.
Okay. We'll return after these messages.
Hey, feeling down? Feeling low? Not enough podcasts about movies in your life? Why not try?
They must be destroyed on sight!
The new podcast cure-all, sure to get you right with the world and on a path to better living. We have exploitation, we have Italian horror, we have zombies, we have slashers, we have crime films, we have spaghetti westerns, we even have sci-fi and sex comedies. So take a dose of...
They must be destroyed on sight!
As needed, and let the hosts, Lee Russell, Daniel Harper, Paul Romali, and the odd guest host cure what ails you.
Warning, may cause atrophy, African consumption, black fever, bone shave, chin cough, colic, cramp colic, dropsy of the brain, elephantitis, grocer's itch, jaundice, mania, miasma, mortification, palsy, Pott's disease, rheumatism, scurvy, St. Anthony's fire, summer complaint, and worm fit in some people. Consult a physician before listening.
Did you ever see a film at such a young age it left you traumatized with cinematic wounds?
Necrophilia.
It's a dead issue, man. Don't push it. Cinema Psyops is a weekly podcast documenting an ongoing experiment on the mind of an unwilling test subject.
No one should have to watch this movie.
Oh, no one should have to watch this?
No one should have to watch this movie.
Surprisingly, it's not a topic that a lot of people really want to tackle.
I'm shocked, Prudes.
I know, really.
Right?
It's the next sexual frontier that no one wants to explore.
I am, in the most sincerest of senses, disappointed in it.
It takes a powerful goddess like Connie, jam her arm down the monster's throat and kill it. Oh, I'm still tripping out over that. Even as a kid, I was like, I gotta find a girl like that. Every week, I get a new look of disappointment that I never thought I could get out of.
Unimaginable. At 12 years old, you should not be watching this movie.
Obviously.
At 13, you should not be. 14, you shouldn't be. I'm not entirely sure even 17-year-olds should be watching this.
Just because you're offended by something doesn't mean that you have the right to demand that it doesn't exist. Watching this film again, I had all of this like little nerd glee with everything that kept
little history
up.
Doll yeah, popping up
absolutely.
At you.
So I totally loved this film.
Hey, I know why you couldn't see that. It's because your brain's warped from watching this shit at 12 years old.
Yeah, this is a rough movie. I told you ahead of time when we were getting ready to do it that it was.
How did
be a
you
rough
watch
movie.
This shit at 12?
Because physical wounds heal, cinematic ones don't. Listen to Cinema Psyops.
Hey everybody, I'm Corey.
And I'm Zach. And we're the hosts of Podcasting After Dark, a cast dedicated to late-night horror and sci-fi of the 80s and 90s, often found on HBO and Cinemax.
You know, the movies your parents didn't want you watching as a kid. You can find us every other week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and Stitcher.
This is what you want.
This is what you get.
It's time, let's check our cue, baby. Pivot with a couple brews, baby. We love good movies. We love the bad ones too. So we watch them all and pass their lessons on to you. Oh yeah.
Bana 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 out. Bana 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 out.
Everything I learned from movies helps to make life a little bit groovy. Where the one last plot holes are gratuitous movies. It's time to get busy with your friend Steven Izzy
at EILFM.podbean.com.
We now continue with our program.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening.
It's a Jacked Up.